Good morning and welcome to this June 17th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and we are always available via podcast. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. It is my pleasure to welcome short story writers Austin Bunn and Thomas Pierce to the show this morning. Austin is with me now. Thomas will join for the second half of the show. Austin Bunn is a writer, screenwriter, and professor, a Michener Copernicus Fellow. He is the author of The Brink, published by Harper Perennial, which we're going to talk about this morning. He wrote the script for Kill Your Darlings and the film's director, which debuted at the Sundance Film Festival and won the International Days Prize at the Venice Film Festival. He's a graduate of Yale and the Iowa Writers Workshop. He teaches at Cornell University. His work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, Zoetrope, the Pushcart Prize, Best American Science and Nature Writing, and elsewhere. His monologue, Basement Story, won the Missouri Review Audio Essay Prize and has been broadcast on WBEZ Third Coast Australian Radio and Michigan Public Radio. His short documentaries, Lavender Hill and In the Hollow, have screened at Frameline, Outfest, Provincetown International Film Festival, and elsewhere. We are going to talk about his short story collection, The Brink. It is my huge pleasure to welcome him this morning. Austin, hi.
Marie, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on. I am such a fan. For anybody who listens to this show, even semi-regularly, they know what a huge fan I am of the short story form. And this was absolutely no disappointment. Thank you so much. So I'm going to give you a chance to talk about the collection, introduce us to The Brink, kind of talk about, you know, the collection as a whole, kind of where the stories came from in general, and then we'll dive in and talk about them specifically.
Sounds great.
Yeah, go ahead. Just tell us a little bit about, yeah.
I'll let
you talk about it because you're better at it than I am.
Sure. Well, I suppose this short story collection really begins when I was in seventh grade, when I took this class, like a gifted and talented class in nuclear war gaming. This crackpot professor had decided to teach 13-year-olds about warheads and nuclear payloads and death perimeters, I think in an effort to teach us the big lesson that there really was no way to win a nuclear war. But at the time when I was 13, I didn't know any better, and I was just a nerd wanting to win all these different competitions we were playing. And I was a kid that grew up really with a great fear of nuclear holocaust, I think like lots of us who grew up in the 80s. And so this class really spoke to me. And I've always been somebody drawn to speculative fiction, science fiction, end time experiences, the post-apocalyptic world. And a lot of these stories deal with that kind of extreme moment in people's lives, much more realistic and naturalistically probably than the science fiction I was reading as a 13-year-old. But the first story in the collection leaps off from that autobiographical experience, actually from that gaming class, and links it to the experience of a young boy whose parents are divorcing, and to try to understand how he can solve the Cold War between his mother and his father. Mm. And so some of the stories are set inside of the Heaven's Gate cult. Some of you, I guess, down in Irvine will be familiar with them and the feeling of what is it like to be in the final days of a religious cult convinced that they need to make the big jump up to a comet. Another story is set with some conquistadors. My mother was a Spanish language professor, and I think I just imbibed everything she had been teaching me as a kid about Spanish culture in the 15th century to try to write a story about conquistadors. Friends joke that it's like a queer period seafaring ghost story. It's all these genres at once. So that's just a sample of the different stories that are in the collection.
That's so great. Can you tell, you know, as you look across the 10 stories, can you kind of talk about your area of concern, what the sort of big questions of life that plague you that you think you keep coming back to and dealing with over and over? Can you kind of, you know, see the recurring themes in these 10 stories?
Yeah, of course. I think one of the gifts of putting together a short story collection, unlike, say, a novel, is that you end up working on these disparate things, and then at a certain point you step back and you realize, oh, wow, they are circling around the same question or concern. For me, that happened about four or five stories in. I realized, wow, all these stories seem to be dealing with these end-time experiences. I think the first story in the collection that I drafted was Ledge, the one I'd mentioned about the conquistadors. Mm-hmm. Then I worked on one about the millennial cult. I just kept coming back to these moments of big transformations. And what I felt for myself was, I think personally, I was a young, closeted, gay kid growing up in New Jersey, and that feeling of having to abandon one version of yourself to find out what was on the other side very much threads through all these stories. In fact, the last one in the collection, the capstone story, is about a middle-aged dad who comes out of the closet and travels to an upstate kind of therapy group therapy session that ends up going really wrong. Mm-hmm. And so this question of coming out in lots of different ways, discovering another version of yourself on the other side of a big change, and maybe, and just to put it into a word, kind of resilience. I'm really drawn to that idea, maybe from screenwriting and dramatic writing, of choice being the central component of what it means to be a character, how people choose and what they decide. And so that's what the fiction is about, people making big choices.
Did any of these stories sort of give you more insights into human nature and life, or do you do them just to sort of tell the story and they feel complete, or do you discover, I don't know if this question is making sense, but
I actually love that question. it's a really good one, and it's a deep one. What I would say is there's one of the stories that comes later in the collection. It's one of my favorites. It's based on a true story. I was living in Michigan at the time and teaching, and a father discovered in the basement of his house a dead baby in a plastic bag. And sadly, he ended up reporting it to the police. It turned out to be his own daughter's, and eventually his daughter was jailed for infanticide. Mm-hmm. And I took that little moment of what it would mean to find this kind of object, this horrible discovery in your basement, and tried to live in that experience in real time. So the story takes place over the next 20 minutes, effectively. Mm. And as I wrote it, and as I went deeper into the story, I really began to realize that it had to do with the father and his daughter and their relationship and what was going to change in it for the worse or potentially for the better. And what I tell people is that as I discovered at the end of writing that the worst thing that could happen, the story's title is The Worst You Can Imagine Is Where This Starts. Mm-hmm. But it turns out the worst that you could imagine turns out to be, in a way, the best thing for this father and daughter. And I won't say more about the plot, but that's what good fiction does for me, is it puts me in the position of these characters going through something and identifies inner resources and that inner experience and how people end up on the other side of something, discovering something new about themselves. And that's what draws me to fiction to begin with. I mean, that's what I want, are these moments, the epiphanies, you know, we might call them, of what happens when you go through something.
That's really what I love of the short story form, is that it gives you these isolated moments. You don't have to live with these characters for 500 pages or for, you know,
right,
generations. You can just live with them through particular life moments. It allows you to explore a bunch of different ones so that it, you know, kind of increases your range of what you can explore. But,
oh, yeah.
You know, I think these, you know, pivotal moments of life where you are making a realization or a transformation or you're on the brink is so much fun.
Name check.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and I would add to that, too, not just diversity of characters and voices. That's what always drew me to short stories. I'm a big fan of the writers who just seem to have this ventriloquist skill of throwing themselves into a bunch of different experiences. Maybe Jennifer Egan, A Visit from the Goon Squad, might be a good example. But I would also suggest that form, like, you can just play with form in ways that a novel, it's much harder to, once you land in a third person past tense, you know, it gets harder and harder to include letters. It gets harder to include the first person. And you can see certain writers try. There's certainly many novels that have tried and do it into varying degrees of success. But the short story form really offers that as a writer to showcase all the different, the kind of skills you might have, the voices that draw you, the stories you want to tell.
Yeah. My guest this morning is Austin Bunn. The book, the collection, is The Brink. One thing I want to get to before I let you read to us for a minute is I think one of the hard parts of short stories are finding the point of entry and the point of departure. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's got to be a very tightly constructed moment in time. And I personally struggle, and I think other people struggle with knowing when you enter the story, when you leave the story. And I was wondering, and these are all so great at that. I was wondering if you could talk about that for a second.
It's very related to theater and to screenwriting in some ways, like when does the curtain open, you know, or how does a character enter a story. I find myself circling around this idea that actually Chuck Palahniuk talks a lot about, called burnt tongue. And it comes from, the canon of that comes from his teacher, Tom Spanbauer, who's up, maybe you've had on the show. He lives in Oregon and was Chuck Palahniuk's mentor. And the idea being that burnt tongue is the notion that a story begins because someone enters the room having just experienced something very powerful and needs to talk about it. And that pressure inside them is what is producing the story. And You can see how this really very much relates to first-person stories. And in my collection, I am drawn very much to the testimonial tradition. Maybe it's because of my background in theater and my fascination and love of the monologue form. The first-person stories tend to be testimonies, people who have gone through something and need to talk. Otherwise, when you're talking about a third-person story, it becomes much more structural, I think. And I'm drawn to things about symmetry, the principle that maybe you want to reveal a deep architecture to your story only at the very end. So it's almost like you walk into a house and you're just exploring it, and at the very end you realize, oh, this is actually, the whole thing has been a mirror, or the whole thing has been, I'm walking out the entrance door. Mm. Just ways of creating just wonderful linkages that way. And truthfully, that's a drafting issue. They say all writing is rewriting. You know, it's very hard to find it in the first draft, but you just start. And then you refine.
How much do you know of a story when you start it? Very little.
You know, I think everybody's really different and every story's really different. Mm-hmm. I find myself really interested in the endings pretty early, partly because I just believe that the ending tells you so much about what matters in the story, and it's almost like if you can tell yourself the ending, you know what you need to put beforehand. Frank Conroy, who ran the Iowa Writers' Workshop for a very long time, talked about how stories are always a mountain and you're carrying a backpack. As the writer, and you only want to put in the backpack what you need to get to the top of the mountain. If you're weighted down by lots of things you don't need, readers will resent you, the story will feel baggy and digressive, so you kind of want to be efficient about it. Now, that's the way he wrote. There are many writers who write, like, you would never say that about Alice Munro. I mean, truthfully, her writing is very efficient, but it feels so rich and full of wonderful character detail that maybe not isn't necessary to get to the end, but ultimately can prove to be so. So, I guess I kind of find myself feeling like I just draft, and some stories it comes early, some stories it comes late when I know where it's going.
I find I often pack my backpack to get to the top, but I can't get back down. That's the problem.
You know, stuck up there. I think some part of that is just getting stories out in the world and starting to try to get them published, and then the event of them getting published is the proof that it's done, you know? You don't always know.
I like that. Yeah, you don't always know. Yeah. I interviewed Ethan Rutherford last time, and he was he has a story out there in one story, and then he'd published the same story, Summer Boys, in a collection, and there's been a lot of changes. So I said, even though you published it, you were still obviously tinkering with it.
Oh, yeah, that happens a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll read to you from a short story called Griefer that I wrote the first paragraph, maybe, God, it took me a year and a half just to get through the first paragraph to figure out exactly what the story was about and also the register of the language because it was so dense. I read it to some students, and even the most, like, technically proficient students were like, I have no idea what's going on in that story. So I had to, like, unpack it and undigest it a little bit so that it could be understood.
Mm. That's a great introduction. Why don't we let you read from that for us?
Yeah.
And I'll remind our listeners that I'm talking to Austin Bunn. The book, the collection is The Brink, and the short story he's reading from, I believe, is Griefer.
Yeah. I just want to say by way of introduction, this story comes from a period of my life when nothing really was adding up. I was living in Louisville, Kentucky, and I was very lonely. And I started exploring alternative online universes. Some of your listeners may not be familiar with World of Warcraft or Second Life. So this is a story that is set inside one of these alt worlds that is turning off. Griefer. Our favorite world was almost over. Tonight when I dropped a countdown clock hung in the game sky, you couldn't miss the bright yellow numbers in the twilight. There were just days left in the also to be who we were. I zoomed to the old homestead in Gajan where I built my manse and gardens and dug my private sea, where Aremi came to me, but the place looked like it was having a stroke, just a throb of pixels, a cloud of bad data that fluxed and ate at the terrain. Years of questing were going to be wiped away, and I could take nothing with me, like the refugee from a dream. I moved closer to brush the metaphysics of it all, and my machine seized. The core was as stable as a stilt on a stilt. I dropped again into the game, this time to the foothills of Origin Park to wait for Aremi. We had agreed to meet each other here, the last place they'd wipe. See, the park debuted on the first compile, ganked from topos of the Acropolis, and the texturing was smeary and low-res, not like a place, but like the memory of a place you drove by in a car. The engineers kept it around as an artifact, proof of how far they'd come. I zoomed to the edge of the gray-green butte. Below me, the city stretched out on five peninsulas into the ocean, a hand on a mirror. Hundreds of players hived at one of the city terminals. The Also's composer, this 19-year-old kid who made the game sound like a nail salon, was having a live farewell jam. If I boosted my speakers, I could just about perceive the twee. At the horizon, the dull gray wall of the exit sparkled with tiny match flares, the lights of players stepping through. See, for the last month, the exit had been moving closer, absorbing grid. The engineers had designed it so that players could off under their own power, ceremoniously and unalone. Transiting through the exit was the official way to deinstall, since the game worked its way into every cranny of your motherboard. If you didn't off through the exit, you'd have bits of the game cluttering your OS and trying to recompile. We'd all go through it soon enough. Above me, players streaked by on aerial, hunting their home populations. The processor couldn't handle all the air traffic, couldn't render all the individual skins, so they went naked like fuselages, arcing in an empty sky. The sight depressed me. Another humiliation in a windless world. That's how it'd be when the lights went out here. We'd all be looking for someone. I'll stop there, Marie.
That's so great. You know, one of the things that I really love about this story, I love a lot of things about this story, so the setting in the world is so visceral, and then you pull out to the real world, which is, you know, mm-hmm. so bland by comparison. And,
RL.
right.
Yeah.
And
I'm trying.
And, yeah, it's so. It exactly mirrors the experience of being, you know, your brain being locked into the computer, and then you look up, and you know, there's a tree outside, and that feels almost surreal and weird. And so, I was wondering if you could talk a minute, because the story is such a great example of creating setting. Creating worlds, creating worlds alongside other worlds that are so disparate and different from each other, and you know, just sort of accessing place, which you're so wonderful.
Yeah, you know, I think as a younger writer, I really didn't understand the value of place. I was living in New York at the time when I was working as a freelance journalist and starting to draft those first stories, and I think I just took place for granted. I mean, it's easy to live in a city like New York and feel really deracinated, and you don't have any place that's yours, and the city feels like it's been written about a million times. And then as I got older and moved around, I started to realize, wow, place really shapes us in deep ways. What you have access to, the people that you meet, the range of their lives, the language that they use. So with Griefer specifically, I mean, what's so great, what I found really exciting about that story is I had this incredibly long leash. I mean, I could write that world any way I wanted. And in my head, I imagined characters just dropping from the sky onto the landscape. I imagined, oh, right, they can fly. Like, there are no physics in this. Like, there's no gravity. And that's something that actually is true from Second Life. I spent a good while exploring Second Life. And just to connect it back to my biography, when I started exploring the game in that lonely period of my life, there was nobody there. It felt like everybody was gone. I had entered this alt world at the moment when people had moved on to another one. And that really inspired the story. So you'll see in the fiction, what I did is I imagined, well, he can't just, if he's visiting places that he's been to a million times, he's not going to talk about them in an interesting way. But if he were to meet a newcomer, somebody who had just arrived to the game, who maybe came with her own set of experiences and expectations, and he found that really enticing, well, that would call out of him the urge to explore and to reminisce. And that's what he does. So he takes this new player around, and in giving a tour in the final days of this world, he begins to have feelings for this other player, and not knowing who she is she really even a woman? But discovering that he has a strong emotional connection to this new player. And that created the tension, of course, in his real life. I didn't get into it in the excerpt, but this main character, Josh, is in fact married. He's in a new marriage, and he's just feeling like his real life just cannot compete with the game in any way, except, of course, his wife is saying to him, look, if you keep playing this game, our marriage is over. And I'll just add there that came from a personal story. I met a woman whose husband was obsessed with World of Warcraft, and she said to him, look, if you don't quit this game, I'm going to leave you. And he said, but you can't leave. I'm getting stronger. And what he meant was in the game, he was just collecting so much power that he was addicted to it. So anyhow, so place, I think, matters enormously. And in that story, I just had this, it had really free license to create whatever I wanted. In that case, the skeleton of a gigantic creature that had tried to annihilate this whole world, and it required every player to team up to bring the creature down. I imagine just a person who could build an entire sea of his own, and a mansion, a lawn maze, and I mean, it's a little punch drunk on the language, but these games are all about language. Right. So that's kind of what I had a lot of fun writing that one.
The other thing that was so great about that story is there's a, I don't want to give too much away, but I'm but I guess I'm going to. There's a great metaphor towards the end of it where he's in, you know, has feelings for this woman in the game. And so the metaphor is to give her access, unfettered access to his hard drive, which, you know, is his emotional landscape. As he said, even my porn collection, he gives her complete access to himself, and himself is his hard drive.
Yeah.
And which is such a great metaphor. And I was wondering how much of these stories are the work, do you think, of your subconscious just coming up with this stuff? And then you're like, hey, that was really smart. That's brilliant. And, you know, working it in, or are these choices really very conscious decisions?
I think it's always a mix. Like with that story I mentioned, I was like, well, how do you take an online relationship to the next level to a person who doesn't even live in your town? And I thought, you know, I've never really read about somebody being able to just like play. I know when I look at a friend's desktop, it's fascinating to me. It's like reading their diary. You see how they organize their mind, and what is out on the desktop is obviously to them the most important material. And so I thought, ooh, what if somebody just had complete control over your computer for a while? Wouldn't that feel really both invasive but also very intimate and almost erotic to a person who was playing a game a long time?
Yeah.
So that was very intentional. Other stories, you discover it. Like I was writing the first story, How to Win an Unwinnable War, and at a certain point the main character in playing all these war games realizes, oh, he doesn't need to be a victim in these war games. He can actually be the weapon. And that I just discovered, I remember just channeling, circling back into my own life and thinking, oh, right, I remember that moment during the wargaming, realizing even though I was a small country in this giant geopolitical game, I could still set stuff on fire. Like, I could still cause problems. And so using memory, realizing every story sets up a certain principle and premise about how what you can do. And so those, if a story is a game, here's the things that you can actually do within that game. So that, those things generate ideas, I suppose.
And I also wanted to talk about, sorry, we have a ESA thing coming in here. I also wanted to talk about troublesome stories and when you think you should give up on a story, when it's not working, when it's time to abandon it.
Yeah. Well, the truth is there's a shadow story in this collection that nobody will read because it's sitting in a drawer in my apartment. And I've been working on this novella for a long time. I'd gotten a lot of positive feedback from friends about like the first 25 pages. I was convinced it needed to be like 60. And I just found myself grinding into the ground. I could not figure out what the story was about. I had like a setting and two characters, but I just didn't know what the story wanted to be. And I worked on it for a long time. I think many of us have these pet projects that you just are convinced will change the world, but you cannot get them to submit. And I know that in screenwriting and in television writing, sometimes we talk about breaking a story. Like if you have a premise or you have a situation that you know is exciting but you don't know where it's going to go, you break the story. You sit there with other writers usually and try to hammer out, well, here's the plot and here's what this character wants and here's where it can go. And I really tried to break that story and I just could not get it to break. It wouldn't break. So I just eventually gave up. And that was very freeing. I think there's a power and an accomplishment to failure, really, especially as a creative person, just putting something aside. And the minute I did that, I was like, oh, this is a short story collection. It's ready to go meet the world. So by doing that, I finally put all the stories together and sent them out. So I trust that instinct, and I've cultivated it a little bit more. I think what's hard for a lot of younger writers is just finding the courage to finish something. I know I have a lot of half drafts and half-baked ideas, and just writing a story to the end. And for me, that connects so much to the idea of what does a character need and what do they want. And as a younger writer, I was often attracted to premise and just fireworks and pyrotechnics in stories and in language without realizing that people really read for character and they read for relationship and they want to see people go through things and come out the other side. And so when I trusted that, my writing got a lot deeper.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that you mentioned about reading for character, I wanted to talk about if there were characters in here who gave you particular problems, either, you know, you had a hard time accessing them, you didn't understand them, you were trying to mine them. Somebody told me that she didn't understand somebody until she was in an airport wasting time and sniffed some scent in one of the duty-free shops. And she was like, I get him now. Now I understand him. And I was wondering if there were characters in here like that who you had just, you know, struggled with and how you finally got into them.
So the third story in the collection called Getting There in a Way is the story of a young newlywed couple that goes to Bali to have this wonderful, you know, just completely romantic and fantasy honeymoon experience. But it's at the same time that the Bali bombings are going on. And and this the bride's experience of just kind of nerves and terror begins to release a story from her background, from her recent background, that tells you a lot about who she is as a person. And I found myself, as I was writing this, just really coming to not like this woman. I was like, wow, she just seems to not care about anyone. She's making a lot of selfish decisions. How can I convince readers to go on this ride with her? And again, this is a story that was inspired from friends who had gone to Bali on their honeymoon and had felt very isolated and dislocated during that experience. And I knit it together to the, with the experience of the Bali bombings that took place in the early 2000s. And eventually what I began to realize with this one character is that she needed to do something. She couldn't just actually sit there and think and feel lonely and separated from her husband and just not communicating well. And so by getting her in gear, gosh, solved so many things. And really what that had to do with was me imagining myself in her position in this wonderful resort. What would it mean to, like, step past the face of this resort, which is all designed for foreigners and wealthy French people and Americans, and go backstage and see what it's like to work there and what it's like to be in service to this fantasy? And when I did that, I realized, oh, right, this is connecting to a part of her character that I hadn't really thought about, that is a person who actually works for a nonprofit and is intended to make good change in the world back in Chicago where she lives. Mm-hmm. And when I did that, I was like, okay, now I can understand. And then it's leading to an encounter. Anne Lamott, a writer I love, I'm sure you know her.
Yeah.
She has this quote in one of her essay collections, which is from Martin Buber, "All actual life is encounter." And I used to have that above my desk, "All actual life is encounter," because this was a good story where I thought, once she steps past that door, who's she going to meet? And when I figured out who that person was, the whole thing kind of revealed itself. A very important day. It meant there was a lot of work ahead of me, but the fate of the story was in that moment.
Do you find that if characters are different from you biographically, they are easier or more difficult to access?
I find myself really drawn to characters who are unlike me. It took me a long time to write something that was autobiographical. At the same time, I think every writer would have to admit that you're pulling from your own autobiography. That's it's the world I know.
Yeah.
I used to be a journalist, so I do love interviewing people. And in the case of the story I was just talking about, I did end up reaching out to my friends who had gone to honeymoon there to ask them questions about it and what happened. I think research goes a long way. So I love hearing about writers, you know, doing research, getting out of their own heads, because I feel like that adds a lot of integrity and depth to the work.
Yeah, right. I have about 800 more questions, but I have only one and a half more minutes of time. So I'll let you end on any advice we should have covered that we didn't cover that you give students or that, you know, you found emerged from writing this collection.
Happy to, because I remember feeling as a young writer, I just hit this wall. I didn't know how stories worked. And I'll say the big discovery for me in graduate school, and it really came from other writers there, had to do with what stories are good at. And it is the inner experience. I think I read a lot of Poe as a young writer, and I read Stephen King, and I thought stories were about event and incident. But what fiction does so well, novels and short stories, is reveal the inner experience. And so consciousness, thoughts, beliefs, hopes, inner sense of failure or frustration, that's what fiction does so well compared to, say, TV and movies, which are about the external life. So the more you can dig into that inner experience, the more rich and more complete your fiction will become.
That is fantastic advice. And Austin, this was a massive pleasure for me. I really appreciate you taking the time this morning.
Oh, Marie, total gift to me. Thank you so much for everybody listening and for you having me on.
Tell me before you sign off where we can find you online, or if you're doing any book tours, or where we see you.
Yeah, I'm headed to San Francisco this week. I'll be at Green Apple Books in San Francisco. Super excited to meet them. I'll be in Iowa City on Tuesday night this coming week on book tour. And you can also, of course, go to my website, austinbunn.com, to read more.
Fantastic. Austin Bunn, the book is The Brink. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you again, Marie.
We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Thomas Pierce will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. We are on Facebook, Writers on Writing at KUCI. We're on Twitter, which I don't know anything about, but I hear we are. And we're on Stitcher, which I also am not so good at, but also know we're up there. I am your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Thomas Pierce's short stories have appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The Oxford American, Virginia Quarterly Review, The Best American Non-Required Reading, and elsewhere. He was born and raised in South Carolina. He received his MFA from the University of Virginia as a Poe Faulkner Fellow. Hall of Small Animals is his collection that we're going to be talking about today. It was published by Riverhead, and he currently lives in Charlottesville, Virginia, with his wife and daughter. It is my huge pleasure to welcome him on. Thomas, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I am a fan of this collection. I could not get enough of these characters, of these worlds, of these people, of prehistoric mammoths. It was all fantastic. So nobody
Thank
introduces
you.
A collection as well as you will. So I'm going to give you a chance to do that and talk, you know, sort of about the Hall of Small Mammals, where some of the stories originated from, what you were thinking about generally when you were putting them together, and kind of take us into your world.
Yeah. That's
sorry. That was a big question.
Yeah, where to begin? Yeah.
Where to begin, right?
Well, I mean, I wrote the story, but most of these stories are written in a 3 or 4 year period of time, and they all are kind of running on the same gasoline. I think they kind of came in a wave. I was riding a wave, I suppose. And I'm putting myself back in that. It's been a couple, you know, two-ish years now since I was in that space, so I'm reaching back into that zone to remember where I was then. The stories, it's a book of stories. They're very lightly connected stories. They definitely exist in the same universe. You kind of get the sense that a lot of these characters are floating around each other, that they have interactions that maybe take place outside the boundaries of the story, of the stories, I should say. So it's definitely a world. I think of it as a world, as a single world in which some very strange things are occurring. as you mentioned, there's a mammoth, and one of the stories has been brought back to life, that a woman who lives in outside of Atlanta, a place that not exactly a comfortable home for a resurrected mammoth. She ends up, for various reasons, having to take care of this dwarf woolly mammoth. And it ends up, she's a spiritual lady, she's a religious lady, I should say, and this mammoth presents a particular challenge for her beliefs. And I would say that's true. A lot of these stories are about people who are questioning what it means to live in this crazy place, this universe, and the stories are often trying to dramatize that struggle. I think that's what unites them.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, something you said early on struck me, that I wonder if you can go back and read a collection and almost see it as a sort of diary or journal of the writer's life, of what they were concerned about at the time, what they were thinking about at the time. And as you look across this collection, you know, if you wrote it at whatever age you wrote it versus writing it at age 50 versus writing it at age 70, I mean, certainly your areas of concern would change depending on where you are in life. And your comment about, you know, looking back at this time and trying to remember where you were, I think is a really appropriate one, that, you know, it is almost a slice of the writer's life, as well as, you know, a slice of life for the characters and for the worlds that they're living in. That's I don't know. That's kind of an interesting idea that I hadn't really thought about.
Absolutely. I think there's something very, I mean, it's kind of artifactual about, you know, a book once it's out there. I mean, for me, it's not, I know for some writers, they can probably go into a book and they can pick out things that actually, you know, were happening to them at that time or people they'd encountered or very specific nitty-gritty things that maybe they strip from their lives in various ways. Yeah. For me, I don't do that quite as much, but it's much more, I can remember what I was feeling. You know, it's more of that kind of recollection versus autobiographical, or which is an interesting kind of time capsule to go back into and look and re-experience. And, you know, I think that my questions maybe haven't changed drastically. My overall concerns, I think I'm still working through some of the same projects I'm working on now. I mean, I'm still working through some of the same things, but certainly the lens has changed some.
Right, exactly. Now, a lot of these stories take place in the South, where I know you grew up and you live now. And something occurred to me about growing up someplace, that writers have a hard time getting away from their own childhood. You know, that wherever you grew up tends to be the place that you keep coming back to in your own fiction. I think because, you know, that loamy time of pre-language when you're just kind of forming your ideas about the world and you can't quite put your arms around them because you don't have the experience yet, seems to draw writers back in over and over again to try and solve childhood pain, but they just seem to live in that spot. And I was wondering if that has sort of been your experience, if you know, are really gripped with childhood concerns, or if it really is the South that's captured your attention, or if it's hard to separate the two.
Yeah, it's definitely hard to separate the two, but it is interesting. I mean, the degree to which, I mean, children are super absorbent creatures, and I think it takes a long time to suss through all the things that we've absorbed, you know, that we not even always quite conscious of. For me, in some ways, setting stories in the South, it's kind of a safe move for me, or in the sense that I don't have to, it's one less thing for me to worry about when I'm writing a story, especially these stories. A lot of them have some wild things happening, wild conceits, I should say. So I can direct a lot of my energy at that and not worry as much about the setting, because, I mean, the South is something I just don't have to work too hard at it, and it bubbles up on its own, and it can be its own thing without me. I don't have to conjure it up. I can conjure other things. You know?
Yeah, right.
It's just one less question mark. So I mean, the South is an interesting, complex place, and it's an interesting place to set stories, especially the South as it is now. But I mean, I can foresee a day, for instance, when I'm not, you know, in every one of my stories, and maybe not all of the ones in the book, even there are stories that take place outside the South. I can foresee a day when, you know, not everything I'm writing is necessarily set there, but I am, you know, for now, I'm still working through it.
And, you know, the other nice thing, because a lot has been written about the South, or, you know, there are a lot of Southern writers, but this is very time relevant as well. I mean, setting is both time and place. And so the South now, or, you know, sort of contemporary South, is also really interesting in how it's evolved and you know, what it's like in the 2000s as opposed to in the 1950s, is its own unique character, you know, in the novel or in the collection. I think that's really great.
I mean, the South as I lived it is so different from, you know, like from, it's not Faulkner or Flannery O'Connor's South anymore. And of course, I lived in a different part of the South. I lived in upstate South Carolina and I-85 corridor between Atlanta and Charlotte, which is the place where a lot of these stories are kind of generally set. I mean, that's the place that I grew up in. And it's, you know, they're strip malls and a lot of, you know, things are a little blander than they used to be commercially. I mean, you know, things have just changed. It's not the same place that it was. And I'm certainly interested in trying to capture that change.
Exactly. My guest this morning is Thomas Pierce. The book, the collection, is Hall of Small Mammals. We were talking in the first half hour also about short stories. The tricky part of short stories being the point of entry and the point of departure, because, you know, they have to be so tightly woven and they have to encapsulate just a brief period of time, you know, kind of a moment as opposed to a generation of a novel. And and I thought your entries were so really so artfully done. You know, the first story opens during a wedding, which kind of never really makes a reappearance in the story, and yet it's really important, or, you know, kind of feels right. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your choices of where you enter a story and where you decide to leave it.
Yeah, it's always tough. I mean, for me, it's easier to figure out where to start it than it is to where to leave it. But but starting it, I like there to be an immediate momentum. You know, if I can at all make that possible, that's what I try to go for. Not to say that we're starting in the middle of something or the reader has to catch up. Hopefully that's not always the case. But just that there's this sense of propulsion from the first, or, you know, hopefully the first sentence, if not the second.
Yeah.
If not the title, you know, something
right.
That's moving the story forward. And sometimes that means a certain kind of scene. You mentioned that story, the mammoth story, and it does take place at this party at this woman's house, and she's throwing for her relatives, and I wanted this kind of sense. You know, the story opens with there's a lot of people around, and then and very quickly she's alone with this mammoth, and 90% of the story she's alone. So I like that kind of balance there between the two, or imbalance.
Yeah.
Exactly. And but yes, I do like things just to. I don't like to waste time. You know, as you say, the short story, it's you only have so much time, so you have to really get moving. The ending, though, gosh, that's the thing I often end up working the longest on, or trying to figure out where the story should settle. And in a similar way, I like there to be a sense of momentum at the end of the story that you get the sense that there's closure, but that the story continues, and that you've just kind of dropped into someone's life in this very trying time, which is the story, but that there's something on either end of it, that they don't exist just in the world of the story. I enjoy trying to create that effect.
Yeah, endings are in short stories are so tricky. I mean, novels, readers really want to know what happened, and if they invested, you know, 400 or 500 pages, and you don't tell them exactly how it turned out, they're going to be really irritated with you. But short stories are just the opposite, you know, where they're very unsettling. You don't quite know what to make of it. It's a bit ambiguous, and yet it could not end any other way. I mean, I feel like it's so difficult to know how to exit a story on a strong but ambiguous note. I don't know if you learned anything over the course of
it. It's really, it's hard to find that right note that's loud enough, you know, but not too loud.
Yeah,
it has to be just the right volume. Gosh, it's so hard. I mean, novels with longer projects, you can be all over the place, and that's kind of expected in some ways, but the short story, it has to be so precise.
Exactly.
Such a precise machine.
Exactly.
And I don't know that I always get it right. Certainly there are people say I definitely don't, but I do. It is something I think about, and I want to get right.
And the other thing that strikes me is that a collection of short stories is its own. You know, there's an arc within each story, and then there's an arc over the course of the whole collection. And I was wondering if you could talk for a moment about ordering the stories within the collection to sort of create the own arc of the book.
Yeah, in some ways, I mean the arrangement of the stories is a larger story. I mean, you're thinking, when you're writing a single story, you're thinking about is there energy? Is that, you know, how do you transition between different kinds of scenes or ideas? And the arrangement of all the stories in the collection is very similar, kind of working. I mean, in this case, pretty early on, before the book was sold, settled on an order that was very close to this one. I think there was one shift, and I'm trying to remember what it was, but this is very close to what we had originally put together. And, it's like working on, I guess it's like putting together an album of music or something. You just want the moods have to flow, but you want there to be maybe a big opening number, and then maybe you dial it back a little bit, you know, and you want a slightly more, just a different kind of mood, and then you pull it back up, you know, crank it back up again, and you just want there to be that nice flow. It was fun to do that, and then, you know, hopefully it all flows right.
Yeah, I mean, actually, to that point, the other thing that you do so well is to really play with light and dark and humor and seriousness and, you know, kind of big, weighty religious questions, but then so many lines are laugh out loud funny. I mean, they're just, you know, I found myself laughing. So, you know, I don't know, your balance of light and humor and levity and gloom and all of that is really wonderful. And I don't know how much of that comes in the revision process where you say, okay, you know, I need more tambourine here and less violin there.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of it is definitely revision. And, you know, anytime I try to write something funny, it's definitely not funny. It never ends up being funny. I guess that's how it is in life too. I mean, it's the same in my day-to-day life. Anytime I try to be funny, I feel like it's just totally a failure. It's only when I'm not really thinking about it, does something come out that maybe is funny enough. But I think that, you know, the book, that balance between light and dark and humor and tragedy, I guess you could even say in some cases, gloom, is probably just a function of my personality. I think it's really just that's kind of who I am, more or less, and that I don't know if I could, I'm not even sure I could write another way. Part of that also is a function of, I really like stories to be entertaining, so I do value humor. You know, I love when stories are funny, and not that they're, I'm not saying I love satire, although I do love satire or, you know, specific forms of humor, but I love when a story surprises me and when that surprise registers as a laugh.
Yeah, that's a gift. That is a real gift. Talk a little bit also about writing dialogue. I know short story writers have differing opinions about this, that some people are very spare with their dialogue and every piece mm-hmm. of dialogue really has to be moving the action forward. This felt very organic and natural and not, you know, contrived. And I was wondering if you read this aloud or sort of your tricks of the right amount of dialogue, getting the voices right, all of those sort of tips and tricks, because I have such a personal hard time with dialogue. So help me out.
Yeah, I think if it was, if I didn't watch myself, I think my stories would be too heavy in dialogue. I love writing dialogue, and I think it's, I don't necessarily always say it out loud as I'm writing, but I definitely hear it in my head as an actual conversation, or, you know, whatever the moment is. I definitely think of it as I'm hearing it play out. And I often in revisions will end up having to cut dialogue just because I'll overwrite. I'll keep going. And I feel that's often for me when a lot of the surprises happen when I'm writing, is when characters are talking to each other and something. Just when the unexpected seems to occur for me. When I'm trying to describe something, that's really arduous for me sometimes. Mm. Trying to make, you know, just in the level of the language being clever and accurate and mixing up syntax and all those things that are about the musicality of it. I mean, I enjoy that to a degree, but and it's I think it's a necessary ingredient because it makes the moments of dialogue that much stronger if they're framed correctly. But I would just keep writing dialogue all day long. It's like so much fun.
Screenwriter is in you, right? My guest this morning is Thomas Pierce. The book is Hall of Small Mammals. The other thing that struck me are the names of your characters. And you've got some really great, you know, Felix and Bert and Mama, which isn't her actual name. But
right.
I was wondering if the part of the process of accessing these characters and kind of getting into them are the great names, or if you can talk about A, naming characters, and B, getting access to these characters and how you kind of get inside their skin and inhabit their world a little bit.
Yeah, names are definitely important for me. Sometimes I'll change a name after I've started a story, but more often than not, the name is part of the original design or impetus for the story, or just kind of tied up in the original idea. And you mentioned Felix, that writing. And there are very, very few times when I've had a title before I started a story. That's just not usually how I work. There may be one or two exceptions in the book, and this is one, that's one of them, Felix Not Arriving, where that name is just part of the whole idea. I just felt right. I couldn't imagine another name. Sometimes I'll change name if it's sometimes they're secondary characters in particular. I'll fiddle with that for a while, or I don't want, especially when it came time to revise the whole collection. I think there were one or two instances where maybe one name repeated when it shouldn't have. I mean, there's certainly repetitions, but they're purposeful, and they're more often than not the same character appearing in different stories. So I wanted to avoid that when I didn't intend it. So that was part of it. But definitely name is vital to kind of getting into a character's personality. For me, the character is number one for me where the story begins. If not begins, then I have to have that before I can really get moving in any serious way. I have to kind of know what they are, who they are. And when I say that, I don't necessarily mean like what they look like or how they carry themselves, although that eventually does come. It's more about what they, they're bundles of emotions and questions, and I'm interested in what kind of drives them, like what they want to know or what troubles them, just that kind of elemental part of their being. That's what I start with. It's kind of the feeling. It's a collection of feelings and maybe a couple of thoughts, and then it grows outward from there. They kind of their organs come later, I guess you could say.
I love that. We're drawing down on our time, but I was wondering if there's advice that we should have covered that we didn't, or advice, sort of tips and tricks that you've learned through the course of writing the collection that you'd find useful to share with other writers.
Don't be afraid to, for me, I try to finish every single story I start, even if I halfway through have begun to suspect that it's going to be a failure. For every one of the stories in the book, there are a couple more, three or four more for each one that, did not work. And you just have to, I think for me, just learning to be okay with that and to let go of the ones that don't work and to not, just to keep moving forward and to never stop and just be okay with that. Sometimes things just don't work. But I think finishing is a good thing. You just never know. Sometimes it's that final moment that redeems the story that maybe it's worth going back into and revising and making it work.
Yeah, that's really intriguing advice, because we were talking about that in the first half hour also, of when you know that a story isn't working and when you know you should abandon it. And the idea of knowing it's not working and yet finishing it anyway, I haven't heard that, but that's sort of, I think there is some value to at least, maybe putting the last nail in the coffin to know it's not working, or writing through to the end to say, well, maybe the ending is really where it should have started after all.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's happened. Yeah. Sometimes that happens. That final moment becomes its own story. And also I think for me, it's forming the habit of finishing. So I think I could easily fall into a bad habit where I start 20 bajillion stories and never finish them. So it's just the discipline of you have to finish something, or else you can't have a computer full of half barely begun stories.
That's pretty much what I have. Have you been looking at my hard drive? Because that's exactly what I have.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I have a large folder of that too. So partially, it's just me trying to force myself to complete stuff.
Yeah. No, that's great advice, because I feel like you just read my short story dying notebook in there, because that's exactly.
No. Oh gosh.
That's funny. Sadly, that's all the time we have. But tell us where we can find you online, and if your book tour is probably over now, because I found you in the New Yorker and hunted you down. But where can we see you? Where can we find you online?
Well, I'm on the usual places. I'm on Twitter at Thomas Pierce, I think that's my, I hope so. Or if not, you'll find some other Thomas Pierce. Might be more entertaining than me. So I'm there, and I have a website. My tour has kind of wound down, but I'm working on the next thing. So hopefully I'll be back out there in the world one day with some more work.
Fantastic. Well, I will look forward to it because I ate this up. This was fantastic. Thomas Pierce, thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for reading it and for having me. I enjoyed it. Thank
you. Fantastic. The book is Hall of Small Mammals. It is out and available to you now. That is all the time we have for. I will be back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. We're doing children's books next week. The Caldecott winner and William Joyce will be on with me next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.